Orb, Volume 1, Number 13, Equality. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. People have more than five senses. We have a sense of direction. We have an often distorted sense of time. And we have a sense of justice, fairness, equality. It is these senses that are coming together as I write this. It is mid-October, 2011. People in North America and around the world are rising up because our sense of fairness has been offended. It has been bothering us for quite a while, and our sense of time has told us that now is the time to act. We have found that our sense of direction is telling us society is going the wrong way, and we need to turn things around. When I set out to do The Orb, I wanted to talk about the forces that shape who we are as individuals and society. I did not want to make it about current events that we pass through. There are plenty of places to find those conversations. I wanted to look at deeper things. As it turns out, we are now at a place and time where it is those deeper things that are shaping current events. Events that I believe embody the most important thing happening in the world right now. I'll get into details of that later in this episode. First, I'd like to talk a bit about the value of equality to living long and well. Most people hold that improving the equality of one's life rests in amassing more and more of the resources used to live it. Basics first, like good food, warm, comfortable shelter, then on to the fun parts, entertainments and luxuries, and finally the security of savings to preserve our access to these resources into the future. This is only partially true. The basics do need to be met. Beyond that, it turns out that the quality of one's life is enhanced by the shared success of those around us. It may seem counterintuitive, but if your wealth grows disproportionately to others around you, your well-being is diminished in proportion to that disparity. Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett are two epidemiologists who set out to understand why health gets worse at every step down the social ladder. What they uncovered in the data was much more profound. Their book, The Spirit Level: Why Equality is Better for Everyone, describes, with extensive charts and references, the counterintuitive truth that as socioeconomic inequality increases, both ends of the spectrum suffer, rich and poor. For thousands of years, the best way of improving the quality of human life was to raise material living standards. But for the vast majority of people in affluent countries, the difficulties of life are no longer about filling our stomachs. Now we wish we could eat less rather than more. Not only have measures of well-being and happiness ceased to rise with economic growth, there have been increasing rates of anxiety, depression, and numerous other social problems. We trade malnutrition and malaria for diabetes and congestive heart disease. Whether looking at health, happiness, or other measures of well-being, there is a consistent picture. In poorer countries, economic development continues to be very important for human well-being. But as nations join the ranks of affluent countries, further increases in income count for less and less. This makes sense. If you have two televisions, a third contributes little to your quality of life. Even the first one contributes less than we would hope, but that's another matter. When your hunger is satisfied, having more loaves of bread don't particularly help you, and might present a problem or threat if those around you are still hungry. Affluent social settings also present new challenges for those on the lower rungs of the ladder. The authors wrote of a young unemployed man who spent a month's budget on a new mobile phone because girls ignored people who don't have the right stuff. Food or companionship? Feed the body or the spirit? Tough choice. The pressures of inequality and of wanting to fit in span the social spectrum and harm all. Studies have demonstrated that people are driven to preserve the social self and are vigilant to threats that may jeopardize their social esteem or status. Where there is greater social inequality, there is farther to fall from one's station, particularly the higher one is to start with. Advertisers play on our sensitivity to social comparisons, knowing we will tend to buy things which enhance how we are seen. One of the most common causes of violence in unequal societies is loss of face and humiliation when people feel disrespected or marginalized. Whenever governments have really wanted to increase equality, policies to do so have not been lacking. They have, however, required threats to a government's hold on power before being enacted. Indonesia used rice and fertilizer price policies to raise rural incomes and maintain the support from farmers. Malaysia introduced specific wealth-sharing programs to balance the status of ethnic Malays and better-off ethnic Chinese to reduce the tensions between these groups. Rather than greater equality waiting until well-meaning governments think they can afford to make societies more equal, governments have not usually pursued more egalitarian policies until they thought their very survival depended on it. When the Arab Spring threatened existing power structures, U.S. leaders recognized the call for change in how governments deal with societies trying to renew their social contract.
The people of the Middle East, like people everywhere, are seeking a chance to contribute and to have a role in the decisions that will shape their lives. Leaders need to respond to these aspirations and to help build that better future for all. They need to view civil society as their partner, not as a threat.
A new generation has emerged, and their voices tell us that change cannot be denied. Those shouts of human dignity are being heard across the region. And through the moral force of nonviolence, the people of the region have achieved more change in 6 months than terrorists have accomplished in decades. We are witnessing history unfold. It's a moment of transformation that's taking place because the people of Egypt are calling for change. And they've turned out in extraordinary numbers, representing all ages and all walks of life, who want their voices to be heard.
It's easy to make pronouncements like these when you're not the one whose power is threatened. What is needed is action equal to words, a domestic policy equal to the ideals of foreign policy. Calls for democracy are really calls for an equal voice in setting the direction of society. Underlying this is people's sense of fairness and justice. When their goals and aspirations are ignored by leaders, political or financial, the people are marginalized. In unequal societies, the marginalized rise up to claim their share of what the social contract promised. It is not just about economic wealth. It is about power to determine the course of social development, and about the elimination of privilege. What I ask for myself, I wish for all. Leaders today can acknowledge that actions harming people, particularly those in countries other than their own, can be more important than economic concerns. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper discussing the situation in Libya prior to NATO intervention.
Oil prices. Look, we're obviously always concerned when these spikes in prices affect consumers, but obviously there are much bigger issues at play here. And let me just be very clear on what is happening in Libya. We find the actions of the government firing upon its own citizens to be outrageous and unacceptable, and we call on the government to cease this kind of violence immediately.
If governments are truly prepared to endure the economic impact associated with supporting people's call for change under some circumstances, we need to determine just where that threshold lies. Equality suggests a balance. A thriving economy is one in which the goods and services being produced are balanced with the rate of consumption. If either side gets out of balance, the smooth movement of money stalls and the economy goes into a downward spiral. Henry Ford understood this. Fordism, an economic and social system that grew up from his innovations in mass production, calls for the worker to be paid sufficient wages to buy the products produced. Robert Reich described the consequences of inequality in his essay, Unjust Spoils. Consider, in 1928, the richest 1% of Americans received 23.9% of the nation's total income. After that, the share going to the richest 1% steadily declined. New Deal reforms, followed by World War II, the GI Bill, the Great Society, expanded the circle of prosperity. By the late 1970s, the top 1% raked in only 8 or 9% of America's total annual income. But after that, inequality began to widen again, and income reconcentrated at the top. By 2007, the richest 1% were back to where they were in 1928, with 23.5% of the total. Each of America's two biggest economic crashes occurred in the year immediately following these twin peaks, in 1929 and 2008. This is no mere coincidence. When most of the gains from economic growth go to a small sliver of people at the top, the rest don't have enough purchasing power to buy what the economy is capable of producing. The problem isn't that typical Americans have spent beyond their means. It's that their means haven't kept up with what the growing economy could and should have been able to provide them. The Occupy movement could be the survival threat that presses governments to enact equalizing policies. Although the current economic crisis is not as damaging as the Great Depression, the coming environmental catastrophe could be far worse. The underlying inequalities in wealth, power, and privilege may be enough to drive people into the streets in sufficient numbers to drive governments into policies that form this generation's New Deal and Great Society.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want to if you want, as you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day. Tell me, where do the children play? Well, you roll on roads over fresh green grass for your lorry loads, pumping petrol gas. And you make them long, and you make them tough, but they just go on and on, and it seems that you can't get off. Oh, I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? When to die. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day. Tell me, why do the children play?
When we form into societies, we agree to limit our freedoms. My freedom to swing my arms ends at the tip of your nose. This limitation on individual freedom is a price we all agree to pay for the benefits gained by joining with others to help everyone grow and thrive. For the social contract to engage people in signing on, we need to ensure everyone is offered the same benefits for the same sacrifices. The rules need to apply equally to all and to the benefit of all. When laws are not applied equally, the social contract is rent asunder. The fabric of society is torn to pieces.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
My conscience tells me it is my duty not merely to proclaim domestic tranquility, but to use every means that I have to ensure it. Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
As soon as we deviate from the equal application of the rules to achieve some goal of greater compassion, forgiveness, or as Ford stated, tranquility, we have broken the social contract. If we find our rules to be disquieting to the social order, then we need to change our rules, not selectively abandon them. Unfortunately, society has not adjusted to this paradigm. In the over 30 years since the Nixon-Ford deviation, we continue to selectively abrogate rules in favor of some perceived desire for not rocking the boat, as though social harmony can be achieved with anything less than equal application of the social contract to its individual members.
I don't believe that anybody is above the law. On the other hand, I also have a belief that we need to look forward as opposed to looking backwards.
Of course, the shift in power from people to corporations presents another threat to the social contract. Although the specifics of an item that came my way over Facebook may not be fully agreeable, the underlying theme of the cultural shift is well illustrated. Julian Assange takes private information from corporations and governments and gives it freely to the people. He is vilified for it. Mark Zuckerberg takes private information from people and sells it for profit to corporations. He is named Man of the Year. Agreed that there is an issue of consent that makes these two cases differ. But is that really the kind of consent that rules the social contract? People join the social contract because we believe we will be treated equally with other members of the society. Are we agreed that the social contract should allow corporations and governments to join the same contract? Are they really equal with people? We've reached a point where people must serve the needs of the economy, tightening our belts and granting concessions to corporations, rather than the economy serving the needs of people. Government intervention in labor disputes used to be limited to health and safety issues, such as fire or police services and hospitals. On October 21, 2011, the Canadian Labour Minister, Lisa Raitt, spoke on CBC's Power and Politics.
Our code is specific that it has to be health and safety in order to avoid a work stoppage or to have a maintenance of certain activities. And that's the way it is. But we are seeing more and more this notion of the economy. We take a look at what the general effect on the economy is going to be, and that determines what level of interest the Canadian government has in making sure there's not a work stoppage. What we do, and of course you can see that in our legislation, is that we deem, not necessarily in terms of essential services, but when we see there's effect on the national economy, we introduce an act in Parliament to ensure there's not a work stoppage.
Even if you agreed that corporations and governments are equal members of the social contract, they are exercising power that shatters the equality. The economy appears to have precedence if the few who claim to be its caretakers deem it so.
Years passed. The seasons came and went. The short animal lives fled by. The completed windmill stood as a monument to its builder's faith and sacrifice. But the animal's revolution was only dimly remembered. Outwardly, Animal Farm appeared prosperous. But the animals themselves were no better off, with the exception of the pigs and their supreme leader, Napoleon.
All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
When reports of this great change reached them, other animals everywhere were incredulous. Dismayed and indignant, they headed toward Animal Farm from all directions, instinctively uniting once again in common cause.
Have we so easily forgotten Orwell's warnings? Of course not. As I record this episode, people are uniting in occupations around the globe. Dean Douglas Stout is the Dean of St. James Anglican Cathedral in Toronto, where Occupy Toronto has set up.
The underlying issue is not tidy parks. The underlying issue is increasing economic disparity. This is what is triggering this movement, which is global. The governor of the Bank of Canada said it is a constructive movement.
I spoke earlier of equal application of the law. What must also go with that is equal benefit of the law. In a radio panel discussion on evicting the Occupy movement, the host, Anna Maria Tremonti, speaks with Rick McIver, an entrepreneur and former alderman in Calgary.
They would maybe argue that if they have to follow your rules, it's not their protest.
You got to understand, it's not my rules. It's the public rules that everybody else has to accommodate. I don't have any rules. I just want to see the same rules that apply to me apply to everybody else. I can't camp in a city park if I want to, and I'm okay with that. That's the rules. I would expect everybody else to have to be required to live by the same standard. I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
What is unsaid is that some rules are granting privilege to some and not others. Simply applying rules equally is not enough. Those who have the privilege often seem completely oblivious to the inherent inequality of the rules. On December 1, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks refused to obey bus driver James Blake's order that she give up her seat to make room for a white passenger. The rules did not benefit all. They conferred privilege to a few. So now the Occupy movement is sitting where some people and some rules say they shouldn't. The occupation itself is the political expression of people who feel the rules of our society are not equal. They are not equally applied, and they do not benefit everyone equally. None of us can thrive in a society bearing the inequality of a small number of people receiving an ever larger share of wealth, power, and privilege, while everyone else is receiving a declining share. Rich and poor are equal in their need for fresh water, clean air, and non-toxic food. Corporations are immortal without any of those. The lopsidedness not only diminishes economic growth, but also rends at the social fabric. The most fortunate among us who have reached the pinnacles of economic power and success depend on the integrity of the broader social system, which in its turn rests on the public's trust that the system operates in the interests of all. Any loss of this trust threatens the well-being of everyone. We will choose reform because we are sensible people, and reform is the only sensible option we have. Would you say that Rosa Parks should have just shut up and moved to the back of the bus? Are you saying that the occupiers should just shut up and go home? Our society needs mending. It starts when people come together as equals and discuss how to move forward together. The Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.